The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
And welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I can say this is probably the furthest I've ever flown anywhere to do a podcast. I am at Ash Street Cellar in Sydney, Australia, with Australia's first master somm, Franck Moreau. Franck, thank you so much for doing the podcast today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I was wondering if you could explain to everyone, I want to talk all about the master somm and how it felt when you got it, because I think people are always interested in that journey. Your job as like the head sommelier with Merivale, for people who don't know, I was wondering if you could just tell everyone just what your job's all about.
So now I'm the group general manager for beverage. So overseeing the full beverage for a very large hospitality group in Sydney. Mm-hmm. We've got over 100 different type of venue, from simple pubs to the premium restaurant. Mm-hmm. So I manage a team of over 40 sommeliers, hundreds of bartenders, mm-hmm. and also the back of house sellers as well, and retailers. Very diverse job, because you can work on spirit, nightclub, cocktail with plenty of cocktail bar, to some very premium wine from some fine dining restaurant.
So then you're in charge of the beverage departments for all these ones, from restaurants, nightclubs, stadiums as well. You're sort of the managing director of all things beverage.
Correct, yeah. Correct. So yeah. Managing with from the supplier part to the team part.
I wanted to start here. We sat down. I'm like, oh, wait a minute, Franck. And I can see there's a wine list here. Let's see, there's about six red, six white. And this is your, technically, even though you didn't put this specific one together, this is your wine list.
Correct. You know, I mean, I kind of approve or overthink and give my soul and advice on everything, you know. But I'm lucky to work with some very talented people around me, so I don't have to work too hard every day, you know.
So when you saw that list, what was your reaction? Like, did you know that was going to be it? Or were you looking at it going, oh, okay, so they got the 22 or so. Like what for you when you see a list at a restaurant that's one of yours?
I mean, I always be proud to see what the team can come up with. And also, you know, always took a good diversity. For me, I want people learn new wine, find something interesting. Mm-hmm. And also looking at the price point for every budget as well. Because I think, you know, you have to think it's a budget for every day.
Mm-hmm. We'll circle back. I'm wondering, how did you feel the day when you found out you had finally got all the certification and you were a master somm?
I mean, it was a big relief and happiness. And yes, I mean, all the hard work has been put through. And in the same time, the little story, I left my wife at hospital to mm-hmm. go to my master sommelier, because my plan to be passing my master sommelier was not, it was planned. My baby was supposed to be born in December, mm-hmm. and my master sommelier was in October, and my baby born 2 months early. So it was a very tough decision to flew from Australia to London and leave my little 1.2 kilo baby in hospital and my wife with that. So my wife said, it's enough sacrifice, go. So I had the pressure to say, I need to come back.
Oh, yeah.
With a red pin, you know?
My God, I mean, normally it's a ton of pressure, because you dedicate so much of your life studying to be a master, and yet now you've got, the stakes were even higher. What were the hardest moments? Like, for people that are just starting to study, what are the most difficult parts were it for you in terms of just theory and tasting? I'm always curious about what the most amount of hours you were spending just studying.
I mean, it's a lot of commitment, and as every job, everything you want to do, you have to be able to commit this time and maybe forget a little bit of party for a while and put the priority where it's important. So the study, I would say, is the longest part you spend to do it.
How lonely was that? When you're really studying, you have to kind of say goodbye to some parties or friends, and you're not going out as much, and you can't spend as much time with family, because when you're, you know, especially during certain periods where you're really drilling down.
I'm enjoying study, so I don't feel like I'm punishing myself. And I think you need to find a way to enjoy the way you're reading, the way you study, opening books, looking at different documents, from internet to books to things you've wrote, some magazines. So as much information you can get, and building your own Bible, what I call it. And I kind of enjoy to create this my own Bible, and I'm still having it. You know, it's all these documents put together. So I think for me, you have to look at a way. And I always say to people, if you study just for study and you don't enjoy it, you maybe going to struggle. So look at way of, if it's more imagery, from the graphing, from the maps, from where everything is situated, for me is important. Because, and sometimes we go in a little bit on the nitty gritty because we find something we don't know and we go a bit too deep time to time. And I think to understand, okay, maybe this is for another time. And I think I enjoy to do the traveling as well. So, you know, I think make a little bit of theory and make a travel. If you can do the both together, if you got the time, help a lot. And I was lucky to travel a lot around the world to visit some many, many vineyards and help me to make the dot and the connection between theory and a bit of enjoyment.
It's funny. It's something I've never discussed with any master psalm, the importance of travel. It must help so much when you see these rivers or mountains and, you know, you're feeling the cool from the lake effect and what that does. That must really help when it comes time for the exams.
It's 100%, you know, and I think to... is one is a connection between what you study to what you see in real life. Mm-hmm. You know, to go to Germany, understand the real name of the real name, because it's quite hard to pronounce or try to remember. And when you've been there, I think it come naturally. You go to South America or go to a little village, a little appellation called Colares in Portugal. You was lucky to be able to do a lot of it. It's something vineyard I haven't visited yet. But I've been lucky to put a lot of time and effort to do that.
I found when we went to Burgundy for the first time, that really kind of hit home. It's like, oh my God, it's small. And you could just, you know, you see everything. You're like, okay, near the road, that's one you can afford, but it's not going to be very good. And you go up the hill. Okay, that's going to be yummy. Oh, you're in the middle of the hill. You'll never afford that one. And then you're at the top. Maybe you can buy that Burgundy. Like it just geographically, it really connected.
Everything makes sense. Yeah,
yeah, and, exactly.
And so, I was lucky to born in Burgundy. So my Burgundy was kind of my strength, you know. And I remember the MS, the question about Burgundy. And
what was the question?
It was something around tender. They were they translate the name Tonnerre, of the town of Tonnerre, at Tender, and they wanted to organize. And I say I knew, and I say I can't have one question wrong about Burgundy. No.
What was the hardest part of the test? Like, and I know it's in several parts, and it's not all in one day. But was there one part that you found that was the toughest for you?
I think for me the tasting maybe the tougher, because you know it's about the day, it's about the moment, about the wine. It's a lot of thing you can't control as much. The theory, mm-hmm. If you put the hard work, I believe you should pass the theory. I think the testing is a little bit more about how you're going to feel the day. And yeah, it's not only luck, but it's a percentage of plan. You can't very much plan for it.
Yeah, well, because you never know. It's random. They can spin the wheel, and next thing you know, it's just aromatic whites and the non-aromatic from Portugal or something, and then everything can get screwy. So you mentioned born in Burgundy. How do you go? I think it was Mâcon. Was that where you were born?
Correct, yeah. But I live in Beaujolais.
So how do you go from Beaujolais to now, you know, being such an important part of the wine scene of Australia?
I mean, I've been lucky to work with some amazing people around my time, what helped me to grow where I am today. And I come from a village of 350 habitants, so very little village. Always be passionate about hospitality, and is where my love of hospitality came. And when I started hospitality course, I realized, I don't want to be just a waiter or maitre d'. I need to make a specification. And maybe I tasted one maybe earlier than I should. everything around me was a lot of wine. So I shall say maybe it makes sense for me to go to the wine part. And I work with some amazing teacher at school to... lucky to work with some great mentor in restaurant, where when I finished school, my teacher from my one school told me, Frank, I've got a job at the end of I finished school. And she introduced me to a person in Lyon, where we were it's a two-star Michelin with three table, only 12 table and three sommelier. So learning very much the hardcore basic, but you know, how to be a sommelier. And this person got me a job in Paris, and this person, somebody from Paris, gave me a job in London. I work for Gordon Ramsay. Here I met my wife, and my wife is Australian, and I moved to Sydney. Because my wife is, I met my wife in London, but she's from Sydney.
Okay, so
it was a link of it.
Right, okay, so your wife played a big part in how you go from Europe to Australia. Now, I have to go back. You mentioned Gordon Ramsay. Is he as loud in person when it's just you're in a closed door, closed meeting as he is on TV? Because it feels like that has to be a bit of an act. To be that loud and energetic all the time feels tiring.
He's definitely got a lot of energy. I would never say anything bad. I've seen some, as I say, if you do the right thing, mm-hmm. they look after you well.
Yeah.
Is when you maybe don't work at the perfectionist, mm-hmm. Where I think can go a bit on the other side. But, I was very young age and they gave me a lot of amount of trust mm-hmm. around the work I did this. And I was at Claridge's. And after I worked mostly a little bit to all their restaurant, and they gave me the position of head sommelier of the Savoy Grill when I was 22 years old. So
you were 22 yeah. with that job.
Correct. So it's not many people will give a chance. So I would never, they very trust me. And the Ronan and Christopher, the time the head sommelier there, was very much the team behind me to support me to get the mise.
How did that feel? You're at such a young age, with such an important role at that restaurant.
I was one of the hardest part because I was maybe the youngest person and I had to manage a team of a much older team, because we were taking over the Savoy Grill, such an institution, mm-hmm. and a lot of team been working there for maybe too long, it was quite a good maturity, helped me to mature quickly because I had to manage people where they maybe on their way to, they were been doing the same thing for a long time and we were trying to change things.
Right.
And I remember my first day where we were still smoking cigar in restaurant and we decided we won't be able to smoke cigar. And very English style, the guy finished a meal and he said, "Can you bring the cigar?" I said, "Bring the cigar box." I said, "Yes, of course, bring the cigar box and with a port." And we, I say, "Can you select your cigar?" He said, "Yes." And I said, "Please, I'm going to organize a table to the lounge for you." And the guy cut the cigar and light it in front of me. He said, "What are you going to do, young man, now?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Sir, enjoy it." You know.
How much of a cultural shift was it for you? So you go from that environment and you grow up in Beaujolais, and now let's flash forward to 2004, the Head Somm Pier restaurant in Sydney. How much of just a culture shock was that early on for you?
Oh, it was huge. Living in London and arriving in Sydney, and the wine industry in Sydney was not as exciting as it is now 20 years ago. And definitely, I knew I had to take a step back. I knew I wanted, after three years in London, a bit more than 3 years, I wanted a bit more relaxed time for a while. So it was perfect to learn a new culture, meet new people. New industry, the industry. I didn't know anyone from the industry, so you have to reset yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think Pier was the right place because it was a small, good team, and I had time to learn and watch and right. see. Definitely not the most exciting and a bit boring at time, but it was a good place. And I say something to my wife: say if I don't enjoy the job, I'm going to move back to Europe.
Yeah. And what was her reaction to that?
And it was the reason I'm where I work now because yeah. she. So it was a job available there, and she applied for me mm-hmm. on my behalf. And she called me after. She said, "Oh, by the way, I sent a resume to Maryvale, where I am now." So I remind her from time to time. I say, "You can blame only yourself if you don't see much more of me sometime." You know, no, I'm just kidding.
The wine scene, how different was it then versus now? And I know that's a big question, and there's generalizations, and it depends where you are, but. I mean, how different does it feel for you in 2026 versus 22 years ago?
The wine industry, it changed so much. Sommelier was almost, it's only a few people were sommelier at the time. So it was only a few key restaurants at sommelier. One sommelier was not big teams or anything like this. So it was very much a new, not new, but it was a change. It was evolving mm-hmm. and very Australian-based wine and very bold, the classic big Australian wine what we know was very much what people wanted. And, is nothing wrong with this wine at all, but is what the culture is. They haven't seen not much export wine was coming, a little bit, but not
much, you know. And I think the change now, we find mostly everyone from around the world coming to Australia, some country much more open. And also the wine industry changed so much, you know. People have been traveling much more. They make more wine, more elegant. The oak regime is managed much, much better. The technique improved. The quality improved. And I think now we are one of the lucky country because some of the incredible wine from, you know, when we talk about Barossa Valley Shiraz, where people think big, rich, inky, extracting. Now you can find some much elegant, pick early, lower alcohol, finer, softer, excellent. And some of the Chardonnay for me. The Chardonnay grape is maybe one of the best Chardonnay around the world and still good value comparing to many other countries.
Yes.
So I think we're very lucky, you know, and many different style of region and diversity as well.
Did you have to fight managers or restaurants or when you worked at Maryvale, which was in 2005, because certainly back then, you know, more of the Shirazes are going to be, you know, bigger and, as you said, just bigger, more fruit bomb. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's funny. There's nothing wrong with the fruit bomb. If it's well made and big fruit, there's a place for it. But you come from Rhone and you come from just such a different way of making Syrah than, say, in Barossa. Did you have to sort of try to get more of you, more old world into this environment?
Definitely. I mean, you have to adjust yourself. You have to adjust your palate as well.
Right.
Adjust other people want to drink it as well. And, you know, you have to step by step introduce new thing. And I remember, you know, I did like 20 years ago, and now it's we've seen everywhere. But I did a little bit of Sauvignon wine with Conte cheese, just to, and people say, what's that, you know? And, you know, so introducing a little bit what great thing we can show and a bit of my culture as well in the same time, but also work with winery, tell them what we can change and, you know, and show you your palate as well, what you can develop it. So I think it's about collaboration, communication.
Right.
And my view was, I could move back to Europe or I can make a difference in a country. And think I kind of put this way. I say, you know what? There's a lot of to do for the industry here and great people. And the Aussie people are the most nicer people. They're very welcoming, a lot of fun. They don't take things seriously time to time and you can have a lot of fun. So I think I enjoy this part.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it must have been so fun for you because it is a different culture. It is a different style of wine. It has to be a different style. It's a completely different geography and different laws than all over France for you, than France versus Australia. I mean, that must have been a fun challenge. I mean, probably still is today, but just such a fun challenge taking over a completely different wine scene.
Yes, it was a big challenge. But, you know, it was some days better than others. But, you know, I think, you know, if the industry was not supporting me and helping me, I would not be where I am now today as well.
What are some of the stereotypes that you want to try to turn people's opinion when it comes to Australian wine? Because, for instance, in Canada, people don't know Canadian wine. They just think ice wine. That's it. Oh, ice wine. And ice wine certainly helped the Canadian wine industry to get people in, and then they try the Chards, they try the Pinots and things like that. And then when I think of Australia, if people don't know anything, they go to Yellowtail. They think Yellowtail, just big mass-produced wine for all its flaws, but also it brings people in, and then they start trying other stuff. But like, what would be some of the stereotypes you would want people to tell people, hey, Australia is not this one thing?
Definitely not Yellowtail. Yellowtail is definitely a very commercial style of wine made for a certain palate. Great success, but definitely opposite what Australian wine. I think stereotype is about the big heavy Shiraz as well. I mean, it's still many of them with big coconut flavor, big inky extraction. I think the big buttery Chardonnay and butterscotch flavor as well was kind of a stereotype. We found it. But, you know, every region improved so much. So now you've got elegance. I mean, I discovered like Semillon from Intervalle. You got the closest vineyard from Sydney now. And you got the Semillon can be very tight, young, but with age makes this lovely almondy, nutty character. It is incredible and very precise. You know, it's a unique wine where you don't find not many 100% Semillon around the world and high quality. So it makes you also discover, and with a new generation, many new producers coming, and they're improving and they're changing the way of people think the philosophy of each wine. Grenache, all Van Grenache. We've got some oldest vine in the world in Australia, and you know, making some incredible wine.
Speaking of Grenache, I had this note just I saw in an interview. You're a big fan of Bonnie Dune?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. You know, yeah. I've been there. You know, absolutely. You know, the Chateau du Pape of California. You know,
I've interviewed Randall Graham, which was an absolute thrill, and just. I mean, I love, I don't know if it's on any of your lists, but I noticed in an interview that you were waxing poetic about
so
it.
So you got the Cigar Volant in America, in the US,
yeah.
And in here you got the Nine Pops. Mm-hmm. So the Nine Pops is a Chateau du Pape of Australia. Mm-hmm. And if you never had Charlie Melton Nine Pops, it's an amazing one as well. So you got the comparison. So we've got similar style. In different country.
When you're approaching a restaurant, what are the things you look for? Like when you're going to be putting together a new wine program, what are the things, what are the most important factors that go into your decisions about what you're going to serve, you know, in terms of the white, red, sparkling, rosé programs? What are some of the key factors?
Firstly, what the team, what the food, what we want to do, I think very important first, because you know, if you're going for a French or Italian or Mediterranean style restaurant, whatever, Lebanese, the food have to be directing. And after, what kind of demographic? Where are you? Are you in a city-based restaurant? Are you a regional restaurant? What kind of people are going to come to your restaurant? For me, is what I'm looking for us, because it's going to help me. And after, I try to having a right balance, you know? It's easy to do one list from what I like to drink, or what my customer want to drink. And I think the mistake I've seen the most in around the world is I've seen big lists made for sommelier, but not for customer. And in my view, you can come to my house, you'll have some good wine, and I will do what I like. But if I come to my venues, I want my guests to have wine they want. And having a balance between discovery to big brand to what the new upcoming star, a rising star, and unique one as well. So having a right balance, and right balance in price as well.
Did you have a hard time with that early on? Because I know if ever I was working at a restaurant and putting a list together, I would be screaming. We're having so much Mosel and Rheingau. We're going to have so much German wine here. And then a month later, we'd be out of business. And I'd be like, I don't care. These are the wines that I love. Like, because the passion projects for the Somme aren't always what's going to sell and keep the lights on at a restaurant. Did you have a hard time with that early on, or did you realize, no, we are here to make money?
I think everyone in the journey got the, as you mentioned, you know, we a bit of ego when we start our journey, and we think we know everything, and we maybe do a, and after we learn and mature and realize, you know, we, if we work in a restaurant, we work for our guests, we not work for ourselves, you know, and we've got business to run as well. I definitely mature. And I seen sometime young sommelier of my team when they arrive a bit rocky, and I have to take on the side and I say, you can keep a few wine for yourself, but we are here to run a business. And I show them usually after 6 months or a year, I say, oh, by the way, let's have a look at all the wine you bought for yourself. How much did you sell?
Yeah.
Sometimes they're still there. You know.
Now, do you ever have fun with that, going, oh, you want white Pinot Noir by the glass? Okay. Go buy a six-pack. I'll come back in 6 months. Let's see how much of that is sold. I mean, that must be a fun thing.
Yes, definitely play with that time to time as well. But, you know, it's part of the learning. You know, if you have to learn by your mistake, you know. And I think, you know, if you don't learn by your mistake, you can't grow.
Two things I saw in an interview you did back in 2019. For people listening, advice you would give them when it comes to they've tried a wine, but they don't like it, and they feel bad trying to return it.
My view is, again, if you're young somebody, sometimes you say, no, you have to drink it. But no, my view is makeup is a guest, you know. It's always a way to sell the wine differently, do something about the glass. You know, a guest happy is a guest coming back, is the best talk about yourself. So, you know, if people are prefer, if you don't like it, you don't like it, let's find something people enjoy, have a good time. If you go to somewhere and you don't enjoy something, you've got a bitterness in a mouth, I've got it, where you're never going to come back, or you're never going to enjoy yourself. So you know what?
we are selling dreams here. We are selling experience. We're not here to tell people what to do, you know. I've got people coming and having a dozen of oyster and a bottle of Shiraz. If they ask me my opinion and say, what do you recommend? I would maybe not recommend this. I would give them maybe a nice glass of wrestling or a glass of champagne or a manzanilla sherry or something. But, you know, if they're happy to having a glass of Shiraz with their oyster, so be it, you know, even if I don't think it's the best match and I don't think, but we have to listening to the guests, you know, and yeah. It's the same if a guest say to me, I like full body Chardonnay, I'm not gonna try to sell a Chablis to them because I know they're not the style they wanted. Right. So, you know, we have to listen, and I learn a lot about maturity. Helped me too.
That is there's maturity there. The very least, at least give them the coolest climate Shiraz you have if they're going to be having that with the oysters. So, when you're at a restaurant, how annoyed do you get when you order a glass of red and it's too warm?
I get more and more upset about it because I think must in Australia, something I a day like today when we got 35 degrees. Room temperature is definitely too warm, you know. And learning how to make sure we've got wine at the right temperature, it's hard from time to time. And I would say to the team, I prefer we serve a little bit cooler because it's easy to warm up something than something too warm is very, very hard to cool down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it is definitely a learning, and I think we've got a lot to do around the world on this. But I think a huge improvement. And I believe we drink a bit more when it's cool as well. Maybe myself. I feel like if it's the right temperature, I drink a bit faster. It's good for business.
Hey, listen, the Buy the Glass program, that's how you make your money. And when it's too warm, it's not enjoyable. You know, and yes, I can't stand that. Or you see a restaurant and you can see the sun is beaming down on their red wine and it's infuriating. So you're ruining your product. All right, I want to go back to your list of all the wines there. Which one would you want to have tonight?
Oh, it's a decision because I like most of them on the list. But you know, I've got a bit of a weak spot or a great memory about Biondi Santi. Mm-hmm. You know, I love Italian wine. Rosso di Montalcino, great value wine from one of the best producers of Tuscany. So, you know, I was lucky to be visiting them when Franco was still alive and having a tasting at the cellar with Franco Biondi Santi, one of the iconic moments.
By the way, you mentioned sherry. That's a tough sell, isn't it?
Yes, again, it's a sommelier sell, you know. But I think it's about our job is to help people to discover a thing or to put them on the front of people, and they are. I didn't think about it, and great sherry is amazing. Mostly with perfect food is even better. But you know what? Having a beautiful manzanilla as an aperitif is incredible with a tapas or a few stir is like very exciting. Well, I got some best food and matching with and I did that for a long time. We had a fine dining restaurant where we have a venison consomme, and I was serving this palo cotado with it. And I think the smokiness, the texture was absolutely incredible. And people were like, oh, what is it? And, you know, it's your job to make something unique.
In the end, that's your job. It's and the psalms and the people working on the floor, they're storytellers. That's, you know, one of the most important things when, especially if you're trying to get someone to try sherry. I remember I went for my WSET diploma graduation ceremony in London, just geeking out at the sherry bars there. It was really cool. All right, as we end this, Frank, what's got you excited? What is coming up for you in the next little while? You know, you were saying before you're now, you were doing like stadiums for, I think it was for rugby or for cricket, which, I mean, that must be different. But what's coming up that's getting you excited?
I mean, for me, you know, beverage world maybe, you know, is great, and I love the passion. For me, it's about how I give back to other. Is my view is about I coach other in their journey. For me, is where I feel the most enjoyment, because you know, you want to look after the next generation, and for me, helping the next generation is something I spend a lot of time and energy on it, because I was lucky to having people help me. Giving back to generation is what we are here for.
Yeah.
And for me, it's the most excitement. You know, when I see people I train or getting the next level
or calling me and say, oh, I'm here now, what are you doing, you know? And I've got a great following on this, and I've got people around the world, because we're lucky to Australia, people coming, working a visa, travel, and after they came back, and they call me and say, I've got someone, can I send it to you to work with you? And for me, it's the most excitement, because I think we have done something right somewhere.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, that must be so cool. As we talked about earlier on, about how, you know, you had a friend who helped you get you set up in Paris and in London and the Gordon Ramsay restaurant. And it's so important in this industry is having mentors, having people that believe in you, people that you know, trust you as you know, becoming the head somm in your early 20s. That was trust. And for you, that must be thrilling, being the mentor for that next generation.
Absolutely. I've got a very good person. Manu now is at the Cheval Blanc in Paris. He worked for us for a while. But, you know, I'm very proud to see them shining at the top stage and doing very well. And I think for me, it's great, you know.
As we end this, Franck, what message would you give to people that are wine lovers, people that are going to be traveling to Australia? Where should they go? Tips, a message you would want to give people listening who are thinking of making the flight? Because it's a long flight from Toronto to here.
Absolutely. But, you know, you don't regret this long flight. You know, I think Australia is a very welcoming country. And you can visit from Victoria. I mean, if you go to the Mornington Peninsula, Yarra Valley, some beautiful wine region, a bit more cooler climate, what we call it in Australia. Mm-hmm. Go to Tasmania as well, very upcoming region. Again, a bit more cooler and making some beautiful sparkling wine, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Riesling. Of course, you can't miss the South Australia because, you know, such a region. But, you know, region like McLaren Vale, Adelaide Hills, and of course, Eden Valley and Barossa Valley, you know, you can't miss out. You need to travel to Margaret River. Margaret River, I know, is even further. Sunset in the Margaret River with a glass of wine, watching the sunset, is one of the best things you can do in the world. And some amazing wineries there as well, from Cullen to Mosswood to Deepwood to Lowen Estate. That is incredible wine. And of course, if you stay in Sydney, you've got a couple of regions not far from Sydney you need to visit, you know. Of course, the Hunter Valley with, you know, some of the best Semillon. You have to Brokenwood, Tyrrell's, iconic winery. Some of the first vines been planted in Australia. You got Orange a bit further as well. Some great Chardonnay as well. Wine. And, of course, Canberra. You know, even closer. Shiraz Vienna from Kunaklila. Beautiful Riesling. It's some very exciting. You know, Australia is shining so much. And the new generation bring a bit more fun. You know, I've seen so many new wine coming all the time. And I'm very excited about what's coming up. So you will not get bored to visit the wine region of Australia.
And all these exciting wines you can play with and put on different lists, all the different restaurants that you help build all across the country. Franck, really appreciate it. Thank you so much. I should tell listeners that Franck has been great for me, giving advice, restaurants and wineries to go to in Tasmania, in South Island, New Zealand. So I appreciate the time, and I appreciate you doing this, and congratulations on all the success.
Thank you so much for having me, and nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me and this podcast on iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.